We're at the Estancia La Jolla Hotel and Spa, just down a little walk from the Salk Institute, where we had the 7th annual stem cell meeting on the Mesa with the 2nd annual investor and partnering forum. There were several panels. One of them was on cancer and cancer stem cells, and that was chaired by my guest today, who's Robert Wexlerea, who's professor and director of the tumor development program at Sanford Burnham Medical Research Institute, just also down the street. Mm-hmm. Stem cell meeting on the Mesa, lots of institutions around here. And you work on essentially the relationship between brain development, brain tumor formation, with a focus on models of medulloblastoma, which is the most common
malignant brain tumor in kids.
In kids. Do you want to just gloss that for me and give me some sense?
Sure. So, you know, we study normal development and how normal development goes awry and gives rise to cancers. And as a result, we focus a lot on stem cells, since stem cells are the cells that tumors frequently come from. Medulloblastoma is a terribly malignant tumor. And when kids develop this, they're typically treated extremely aggressively with surgery and then radiation from the top of the head to the base of the spine, and then high-dose chemotherapy. And although the cure rates have gone up dramatically because of that, the side effects from those treatments are devastating.
Where is the medulla?
Well, the medulla is part of the brain stem in the back of the head. Medulloblastoma is actually a tumor of the cerebellum, which is just north of that. And it was named that because in the 20s, in 1925, Bailey and Cushing, neurosurgeons who discovered this, postulated that this tumor was arising from a cell called a medulloblast. And this cell, there's no actual cell that corresponds to that, although there are a number of cell types that have been suggested to have those properties. And in fact, it's probably one of the early descriptions of what we now call a stem cell. It's a cell that lives around the ventricles in the brain that can give rise to many different cell types normally, and that when it acquires the wrong mutations can give rise to a tumor. And so I think early on they speculated, without any evidence at all, that this was a stem cell-derived tumor.
Hmm. And so it was subsequently really historically misnamed.
Then. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Why that particular area as the most common site for these
Childhood brain tumors?
Yeah.
It's not really clear why kids develop tumors in this part of the brain more than adults do, and more than kids develop them in other parts of the brain. One thought is that the cerebellum it's a primitive brain. It's a sort of portion of the brain that's almost self-contained. And during development, it undergoes a massive amount of proliferation to generate all of the cells that make up the cerebellum. So there are more neurons in the cerebellum than in the rest of the brain combined. And in order to generate that many cells, the gas pedal has to be stepped on pretty hard. And if cells are dividing a lot during normal development, there's a lot of opportunity for cells to make mistakes, to acquire a mutation that then dysregulates that proliferation and leads to a tumor. And so that may be one reason that the cerebellum is the seat of many childhood brain tumors.
Actually, why don't you give some people some sense of numbers there? I mean, you're talking about number of cells in brain, talking about number in cerebellum. Were you talking about adult brain or just in infant brain there, or child brain?
In the adult brain, there are more neurons packed into the cerebellum than there are neurons in the rest of the brain. And it's on the order of 10 to the 11th, I think. So it's quite a large number, and that's not to, of course, belittle the rest of the brain, but simply to say that during a fairly short period of development, many cells have to be generated, and therefore there's a lot of division, there's a lot of proliferation.
What functions are most associated with the cerebellum, although obviously it's...
It's really interesting.
When
someone gets drunk, the part of their brain that is probably most acutely affected is the cerebellum.
Balance.
And we think of things like balance and motor coordination, so the ability to hit a baseball or to play the piano. It's not movement of the muscles per se, it's the coordination of all the different muscles to fire at the right times. That's probably the most well-known function of the cerebellum, is to coordinate muscle movement. It turns out it also plays really important roles in language function, in cognitive function and in emotional life. And so, for example, there's evidence that that autism has some of its roots in cerebellar dysfunction. And when kids develop tumors and have to have portions of their cerebellum removed, you find that there are deficits in learning and in language function that nobody really quite understands fully why the cerebellum would do that, but it's clear that they do. And so it's a relay center. It's a place where inputs from all over the brain go, get processed, and get sent back out to the appropriate motor and effector areas.
Okay, so how, what exactly, what strategy is your lab doing and other labs in this area doing to combat this problem?
Well, so the notion that cancer arises from primitive progenitors and stem cells has been around for a long time, but the question of which particular progenitors give rise to the tumor is still not resolved for most types of the disease. And the importance of this, of understanding the cell of origin or the cell from which the tumor comes, is that a lot of the properties of the tumor can be defined by the cell that it came from. If it's a stem cell and there are certain signals that make that cell grow, those signals may still be important in the cancer, and shutting them off may shut off the cancer. Likewise, certain mutations will only cause cancer if they occur in a certain cell type. And so by understanding the origins of the tumor, you can begin to understand what are the steps in transforming a normal cell into a malignant cell. And so that's one of the major things that we focus on in our lab, is really to try to understand what are the normal cells from which the tumor comes. Now, an additional payoff to that is that if you know the normal cell from which the tumor comes and you can artificially introduce mutations into that cell in a mouse, then you can create a model of the tumor in an animal that you can then begin to use to study the disease and to develop and test therapies for the disease. And so we've been in the business for a while of developing animal models for these tumors, which have begun to pay off our work and, of course, work of many other labs in terms of pipelining therapies into the clinic. And so, for example, it's now pretty clear for most cancers, actually, that when you talk about breast cancer or lung cancer or brain tumors or medulloblastoma, that these are heterogeneous diseases. And as we acquire the ability to sequence all of the genes in a tumor, we understand that medulloblastoma is not a single disease, but actually probably four or five different diseases. And the answers to the questions we want to ask are different for each of those subtypes. In fact, they're one of the types of medulloblastoma might be more like lung cancer than like the other types of medulloblastoma. And so we need to really understand what are the mutations that give rise to this disease, what are the cell types that those mutations occur in, can we build a model in which the right or wrong mutation happens in the right cell, and then can we study that model to begin to learn ways to treat the tumor. So I'll give you an example. One subtype of medulloblastoma comes from mutations in a pathway called the sonic hedgehog pathway. And this is a signaling pathway that cells use to communicate with each other. And in particular, that's very important for the proliferation and expansion of stem cells and progenitors during development. So in the developing cerebellum, that massive amount of proliferation that I mentioned results in large part because of the sonic hedgehog pathway telling normal cells to divide at the right time. Now, if a mutation in that pathway tells the cell to keep dividing even when it shouldn't, that's the first step in becoming a tumor. And so through our studies of normal development, we know that sonic hedgehog plays an important role in proliferation. From studies of the human disease and of sequencing the genes in medulloblastoma patients, we know that some of these patients have a mutation in that pathway that basically keeps the gas pedal down all the time.
Right.
And through the synergy of those, we now have animal models in which cells in the cerebellum have that mutation. They acquire tumors that look like the human tumor. And we can now use those animals to test therapies. And those therapies have been tested in the mice, and they're now in clinical trials for patients with this disease. So during the 10 years or 12 years that I've been doing this, we've progressed from just knowing that the sonic hedgehog pathway existed to knowing that it plays a role in proliferation, to having these models, to testing the models, testing therapies on the models, to going into clinical trials. And that's kind of the paradigm that we're shooting for, is to take the basic science and really pipeline it into therapies for these patients. And we're now doing the same thing for other subtypes of medulloblastoma, and ideally for other types of cancer, because I think this approach, understanding the normal cells and the mutations that transform them, is really what we need to be able to come up with targeted, effective, and non-toxic therapies. And that's kind of where we're at.
I'm going to ask you about the therapies in a moment, but just as an aside,
yeah.
Sonic Hedgehog.
Yes.
Why? You and I know.
Where does the name come from?
Well, there's many names like that in science. And it's strange how these pathways end up sounding like rock bands.
So credit Drosophila geneticists, because they spend a lot of time looking through the microscope at little flies and have to entertain themselves. And so when they come up with a fly that has a mutation, they'll name it based on something amusing or interesting or memorable. And so flies that had a mutation in this particular gene had bristles that made them look like hedgehogs. And that was the origin of the hedgehog gene in the fly, the naming of the hedgehog gene. A postdoc who was studying the mouse, the vertebrate homologs of that gene, was a video game fan, and Sonic Hedgehog is a video game character. And he decided to call the vertebrate version of this gene Sonic Hedgehog, and it stuck.
Right.
So that's the origin.
Scientists have a sense of humor.
They do, right. Occasionally.
The therapies,
yes.
And specifically why you at a stem cell meeting. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you know.
Sure. So I think part of the equation in trying to find therapies for human disease is really understanding at a very basic level what is driving. I mean, cancer is, after all, aberrant growth, failure to differentiate, failure to die of the cell. So if the cell basically keeps dividing and dividing and dividing, it will create a mass that impinges on the rest of the tissue, and that's what we call cancer. So one of the things that was recognized a number of years ago is that the ability of a cell to divide indefinitely and to create more of itself, so-called self-renew, is shared between cancer and between normal stem cells and progenitors to some degree. And so if we understand the signals that normally allow stem cells to do this, to make more of themselves, we may understand how those signals go wrong in the context of cancer. And I think this similarity between normal development and cancer, between normal stem cells and so-called cancer stem cells, I think is very provocative and has been very informative in terms of understanding the mechanisms by which cells divide normally or abnormally. So I study the cancer, we study the cells that are malignant, but we also study the normal cells because we learn about what makes those cells tick more easily in some cases from studying the normal cells that don't have quite as many mutations. So coming to a stem cell meeting is informative because it's helpful to look at science from your own perspective. It's incredibly helpful to look at science from others' perspectives. And you can do that by watching other people talk. You can do that by having other people watch your work and comment on it in ways that are unexpected because they're coming at it from a different viewpoint.
I mean, a lot of the talks that we saw yesterday involved people taking a cell, say a skin cell, mm-hmm. putting it in a series of dishes, going through a series of factors and mm-hmm. transformations and so on through iPSC and then back to, in case of Parkinson's, for example, a dopamine neuron mm-hmm. in a dish, stuff in a dish. I mean, is this the kind of work that you do? And then looking eventually to transplant things back in, re-inject them into.
I think, so we do a little bit of cell culture. One of the things that we've learned over the years is that cells change dramatically in a dish. They adapt to being on plastic, to being in artificial media with growth factors that come from bovine serum. And so to the extent that we can maintain things in an animal, we tend to maintain the phenotype of the cell, the phenotype of the tumor, more reproducibly. One example of this is people have, for many years have used cell lines that have been grown on plastic and dishes to study tumors. And there's been a lot of very important information that's come out of those. But now that we have the ability to sequence all the genes in a tumor to know what genes are expressed in the patient's tumor, and we compare that to the cell lines, we find that they're very often not, they don't hold up. They don't recapitulate a lot of the properties of the original tumor. And so what we and other labs have started to do is to take patient samples, because after all, there's a limit to how well a mouse can inform you about a human disease. Mm-hmm. So we study the mouse models that are genetically engineered mice, but we also get samples from patients from the operating room, and we bring them back to the lab and we put them directly into the brain of a mouse, into the cerebellum where they were growing in the patient. And we grow them in the mouse and we passage them from mouse to mouse to mouse. These are called direct orthotopic xenografts. And the advantage of these is that when you look at their behavior, when you look at their gene expression, at their ability to form tumors and what they respond to, it's much more similar to the original patient's tumor. And so this tool, in parallel with the mouse models that we engineer, has, I think, made a huge difference in our ability to test therapies. And one of the things that when you talk to clinicians and when you talk to drug companies and you say, you know, I'm going to test your drug on my cell line or on my preclinical model, a lot of them scoff and say, you know, there's really no, you have to do those experiments, but they don't really predict success in the clinic at all. There are hundreds of drugs for every disease that have cured cancer in a mouse and then failed to cure cancer in a patient. And it's true that you will never know if something can cure cancer in a patient until you put it into a patient. But the reality is right now, fewer than 5% of cancer drugs actually end up getting approved. And a large part of that is because we're testing them on really poor models of the disease. So one of the important goals that we have now is to develop models of the disease that are more like the patient. Because it's not really realistic to take hundreds of drugs and do clinical trials for all of those drugs on patients. We really have to have some kind of filter where we go through cells in a dish and we go through animals first.
So in a sense, stem cells in this relatively short period have transformed the way in which people think about doing this research mm-hmm. in terms of disease cure.
Yeah.
Let me mention this piece here and incorporate mm-hmm. that thought in it, if you wouldn't mind. This is a piece by Ole Lindvall. This was the fifth anniversary mm-hmm. issue of Cell Stem Cell. I'm sure you've read the piece. The headline was, "Why is it taking so long to develop clinically competitive stem cell therapies for CNS disorders?" In other words, you know, I'm not minimizing it, but blood's easier to work with than
sure.
brains.
Sure.
And you're in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So are the PD, Parkinson's people, and so on. Mm-hmm. And you already said this is not an easy one. So
it's challenging, and I think, in fact, it's probably more challenging in the blood than we realize, because I think we think of the blood as this sort of flowing river of cells floating around in it, and in fact, the hematopoietic system has a lot of architecture too in the spleen, in the bone marrow. Things are organized. But there's no question that in the brain, there's a level of organization that exceeds that in many other tissues, because cells not only have to do the right thing, they have to have the right shape, they have to be in the right place, and they have to wire up with the right cells at the right time. And that's a huge challenge. So it's not surprising, even if we can get a cell in a dish to behave like a neuron in crude ways, to express some of the genes that neurons express, to fire electrically, to produce neurotransmitters. That's certainly critical, and it's a huge step, but it's only one part of this. And I think getting those cells to do that in an animal or in a patient and getting them to do it properly is really quite a tall order. Now, I think the challenges are different for cancer and for repair of neurodegenerative diseases. But interestingly, I think they involve some of the same questions and the same paradigms. I think that understanding what makes a cell choose a fate, whether that fate is to divide again or to turn into a particular type of neuron, those are programs that the cell regulates very tightly at the level of genes and at the level of the epigenetic regulation, the methylation, the histone regulation, that's clearly unique to every cell in the brain. So I think it's going to be a big challenge, but I think we have to tackle it from multiple angles. And I think the ability to manipulate stem cells in a dish to be able to begin to ask what makes these cells behave the way they do is the first step. I think it's hugely powerful.
Talk to me, if you would, about this phrase which has heightened currency of late, translational medicine. Plainly, there has to be caution in procedures. You don't want to push things onto market before they're ready. But one also senses that there's a kind of a new pressure to hasten and get things to patients more quick. I mean, do you sense that, and how do you deal with it?
Well, it's a challenge, and I think every lab, every investigator is at a different place on that spectrum. I mean, what we do is very close to translation because we're working with models of a disease, and I think what we do is interesting and important. I also think that the things that are much more basic are equally important, and that we would not be able to do the things that we do if it wasn't for the incredible progress that's been made in understanding basic cell biology, basic stem cell biology. I think that it's a healthy balance has to be struck. And I think that in the past, there has been a very strong emphasis on basic science. And a lot of basic scientists have not been interested and not been in a position to translate things. And as a result, I think the public has become frustrated with, we've been doing science for so long, where are the cures? Because taxpayers, the average person, may be interested in the basic science, but they want to see it pay off. And so I think there has to be some pressure to translate the things that are ready to be translated. As you said, I think there has to be caution too. And in this country, overall, we're quite cautious, I think, to our advantage and disadvantage. I think as a community, we've been burned in the past by moving too quickly. Thalidomide is one example. So I think it's really critical to think carefully before we go into the clinic. At the same time, I think the amount of bureaucracy and the amount of expense that's involved in getting a promising therapy from the bench to the clinic is enormous and prohibitive. And we have to, I think, re-examine that carefully and find out if there are ways to safely, but to short-circuit them, to move things that are going to help patients along faster. Right now, it takes a drug, and most of my experience is with cancer, but it takes a drug 10 years to get into the clinic, and it takes $500 million to $1 billion. And that means that there's a lot of things that are waiting in the wings that are not getting into patients. I think that there's a big gulf. I think that scientists are trained at doing science, but not necessarily at moving things to the clinic. Clinicians are very often trained at treating patients, but not at moving science into their domain. And so the pressure's good. I think it's good for us to think about it and to figure out what are the most efficient ways to get the things that we're learning into the clinic? Because at the end of the day, that's what's going to make a difference if we can take the basic science and move it forward. There are lots of really interesting questions, but there's also lots of really interesting translatable questions.
And it's not always obvious which research is going where. I'm actually thinking about this year's Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, shared by two people, Sir John Gurdon, who keynoted here 2 years ago, and Shinya Yamanaka, who induced pluripotent stem cells. John's work, I mean, he's cloning an animal from an enucleated egg.
Yeah.
I mean, that looks like a practical, hands-on thing.
Yeah.
Shinya's stuff looks like, that's complicated bench work and so on.
Yeah.
But they're of a chain, aren't they? They share a lineage which gets us straight into all this stem cell that's going on now.
Absolutely.
And
there are hundreds of examples of this, of, you know, the revolution that we now have in microRNAs, which clearly play an important role in regulating the biology and the fate of cells. Almost everything we knew about them to begin with came from plants, from lower organisms. And had it not been for that basic research, we would be nowhere. So I think that, and even in the stuff that I've talked about, I mean, patched sonic hedgehog, the genes were discovered and their function mapped in flies. if we don't keep doing that kind of research, you know, we may be able to translate what we have now, but we won't come up with the next decade of cures. And so the basic science is absolutely critical.
Yeah. So go back a little and tell me how you, what was the genesis of your getting to this place? And not just, oh, I did science in school. Go back as far as you can. I mean, usually there's a teacher or parents or a book you read or something. I mean, what drove the passion to be?
Multifaceted in my case. So my mom is a physiology professor still at McGill. My dad's an orthodontist and also teaches. I was always interested in science. In high school and in college, I became interested in science journalism, and I actually spent a couple of years as a reporter for Discover magazine after college. And it was a real treat for me because it was sort of like shopping. Being in a candy store, Discover didn't report on the boring things, they reported on the next big thing. And so it gave me a chance to look at how science and how cutting edge science is done. So that when I decided to go back to graduate school, I had a sense of the kinds of things that I thought were interesting and important. The other thing that I did that is different from some people is I kind of bounced around from field to field. So my PhD was in immunology. I did a postdoc in cancer biology. I did another postdoc in more neurobiology related stuff. And I always felt like an idiot because I was learning the field, you know, at the expense of all the other things that I'd learned before. But at the same time, it gave me the opportunity to look at each of these fields from a different perspective. And so when I started to study cancer, I was studying it with an eye towards development and the role, the similarities between normal development and cancer. And it occurred to me at the time, and this was certainly, I was not the first to come up with this notion, but the similarity in the decisions that normal cells make during development and the decisions that cancer cells make as they grow was huge. Cells have to divide to make many cells in the body. They have to turn into all the different cell types. They have to die at the appropriate time. And the genes that regulate this are the same as the genes that get mutated in human cancers. And so that parallel was really striking to me, and it kind of enriched what I was doing and focused my attention on this approach to studying cancer, on looking at cancer as an aberration of normal development. And so when I was a postdoc in Matt Scott's lab at Stanford, Matt's lab is a fly lab, and they were one of the labs that identified the vertebrate homologs to patched, which is an important component of the hedgehog pathway. And so it was really striking to me that a lab that really studied basic developmental biology in the context of flies had suddenly stumbled on a gene that played a role in cancer, and that really intrigued me. And so I started in his lab. I started studying the role of hedgehog signaling in normal development, with the idea that this would pay off in terms of understanding tumors. And I think that's been the case, both for my work and for many other people's work.
Your little off-ramp into scientific journalism, let me just talk about that for a minute, because obviously communication of science, we think, is important. That's why we have the Science Network. We also say that one of the things we do is discussions of issues at the intersection of science and social policy, free of the tyranny of the soundbite. Mm-hmm. And you must have known when you were doing all that, despite some of the wonderful things that are out there, and I'm on the advisory board of Scientific American, so I'm a great fan of all those things, that sometimes the language can get a little awry, and you start reading about a gene 4. And headline writers don't often talk to the people who write the piece, so you end up with a headline which seems rather more sensationalistic
absolutely
is warranted. I mean, do you want to just talk about
that? Sure. I mean, it's been a long time since I've been in journalism, but the thing that struck me at the time, the image that struck me, was of a room with dogs in it and a piece of meat that's thrown in the middle, and all the dogs are pulling at it in different directions. And I started out as a fact checker, as a reporter whose job it was to take every story written by a writer and put a dot over every word vouching for its veracity, whether it was, you know, the distance from the Earth to the moon or the number of dollars it costs to make a drug. And I always felt that the fact checker was caught in the middle between the writer who, more than anything, simply wanted his beautiful prose or her beautiful prose preserved, the copy editor who didn't really care what the words were, but they had to fit in the space, and the editor who wanted to sell the magazines.
Right.
And this tension that, you know, between the truth, the interesting parts of the science, the sensational parts of the science, and sort of balancing those so you get the right mix, was very interesting and very challenging, and frankly, very educational for what I do now, because science writing, scientific writing for journals, seems very different from writing for the New York Times or for Discover Magazine. But in fact, there are a lot of things in common, and there's a lot of decisions that need to get made about what is a fact, what do you know, what is the truth. And even though we're scientists and we're supposed to be dealing with objective data, the reality is that every experiment has multiple interpretations. Not all experiments can be presented, and so there has to be selection of data. And you want to do that in an honest and representative way, and it's not always easy. And so grappling with these issues and really trying to have our science represent some version of the truth is a challenge, but it's something we think about and we talk about in the lab a lot.
Yeah, even writing a paper for submission to a scientific journal, and I'm certainly not comparing them to writing a piece for a scientific public consumption magazine, but there are certain things that you need to do. And one does hear scientists complain bitterly, not infrequently, about the whole journal process, the scientific, the peer review process, mm-hmm. and so on. I've had people say it's broken.
Yeah.
And that's why they've started websites and things like X-Archive and so on, where you are being critiqued directly by colleagues and so on and so forth. Do you have any observations on that?
Well, I mean, it's broken, but I can't think of a better way to do it. I mean, honestly, I think that science needs to be vetted. It needs to be looked at carefully so that we don't lead each other astray. I think that people who are really good at communicating their work have an edge. There are people who have an edge who maybe shouldn't. In other words, I think you can be incredibly good at communicating things that are not necessarily true or important. And so I think we have to be wary of that. But the hard part about functioning in science right now is that there's an overabundance of good science compared to the amount that can be published and, more importantly, funded. And there's also plenty of bad science out there, don't get me wrong, but I think that right now things are particularly competitive because the funding supply is short and people are thinking very carefully about what they can afford to do. Good labs are shutting down because the scientific funding is drying up. And so I think it should be hard to publish. It shouldn't be impossible. It shouldn't be excruciating, but it should be hard to publish because we want to publish what's right. But I think we want what's right to prevail over other forces. And to the extent that we can improve the system in terms of peer review of grants and papers, I think we ought to.
I'm thinking about the complexities of this system now. I mean, large funding institutions, private ones like the Howard Hughes Medical Institute or the Wellcome Foundation, are now funding heads of labs. Mm-hmm. So one has heard from, you know, what's going to happen to the junior researchers mm-hmm. who don't have a reputation yet? How are they going to survive? And the answer has been, well, you know, there's the NIH and there's wonderful things like California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, yeah. which awards grants, of course.
Yeah.
But then to get an NIH grant, we just had this conversation, perhaps you have to be rather leading in your field and producing something which is translational, which will please the public and so on. So there's all these intricacies here.
I mean, it's a huge challenge, and I don't think any of these things are new, but what's happened is the dial has turned far to the left in terms of the percentiles of people who are getting funded. And what that means is that seasoned investigators are losing their funding, but also that junior investigators are taking longer to get it. And frankly, and this is something that I think we're only going to be able to measure in a few years, the students and postdocs who are watching this happen are seeking other professions. They're saying, I don't want to be there. I don't want to have to do that. Mm. To a degree that, I mean, they always have, but it's incredibly acute now. I mean, with pay lines under 10%, it's really tough. And I can't, with a straight face, recommend to everyone in my lab, oh, this is, you know, this is great. You ought to do this. Yeah. It is great. I mean, it's challenging. It's interesting. It's important. But, you know, you have to be able to survive. And in the current climate, not everybody, a lot of people are not going to survive. And so I think we need to fix the system, and we need to fix it soon enough to prevent losing the next generation of scientists.
To banking. knowing all this, having gone, you know, and having your own lab and so on, Peter Medawar's book, Advice to a Young Scientist. I mean, what do you say as a mentor now? What's your advice to a young scientist?
Well, I think that, you know, find a lot of luck is a good idea. But in my mind, science is worth doing. What we do is worth doing if you think that it's interesting and important. And so there are people who respond to this kind of pressure by saying, I'm going to do the easy, straightforward, simple thing. It may not, you know, change the world, but it will at least get me a paper. And that attitude, I think, is dangerous. One, because it doesn't always get you a paper. The things that you think are going to work don't always work. But also because I think that as a field, I mean, science is all about being creative, about solving the next big problem. And I think in spite of the challenges that there are now, we need to keep tackling the big problems. Even if there are fewer people doing it, I think we still need to view ourselves as having that responsibility of uncovering nature's mysteries and solving nature's problems. And I think if we're threatened by the climate, it will be to our detriment in the long run. So I encourage my students, I mean, people in my lab, nobody has an easy project, nobody has a safe project. We're all doing ambitious, challenging things. And at the end of the day, some of them are not going to succeed and others will. But I would rather take on the big challenges and fail trying than do something that I don't think is even worth undertaking. People going into science now need to go in with their eyes open. They need to understand that it's about the science, but it's also about your ability to market yourself to the funding agencies, about your ability to be creative about how you fund your science and look in many different directions. I mean, CIRM is an excellent example of a non-NIH source of funding that has made a huge difference in the ability of some people to do science.
The rightful place of science is a phrase that President Obama used when he came into office. We will restore science to its rightful place. Where be that?
Well, not exactly where we are now, but, you know, I don't fault him. I think it's a really challenging environment to do this in. And I think that one of the things we need to do better, and one of the things that I think is part of this enterprise, is making people more aware of what we do. Because, I mean, I can put my kids to sleep with what I do if I tell them, you know, the right terminology, if I use the wrong terminology. But the reality is, what we do, I think, is really fascinating and can open your eyes and excite you as much as, you know, going to a movie. But we need the ability to communicate that. We need to be able to tell people what we're doing, why it's exciting, and why they should care. And I think if we can do that, then the public will get behind us. And decisions need to be made in a tight budget, but decisions ought to be made with the right priorities in mind. And I think science is a big priority. It should be a big priority for society.
I'm looking at a little piece here at the Sanford Burnham Institute put out about meeting a cancer researcher. There's a lovely picture here of you with your wife, Tanishta, Rhea, and two children. Mm-hmm. Happy, smiling faces. Two people, and she spoke at the stem cell meeting a couple of years ago. I mean, you hadn't quite made it here yet. She came in early. Those are normally busy lives. I mean, how do you manage to make all that work?
I'm not sure we do, but we try. I often say we throw our kids up in the air and one of us catches them. It's a little haphazard. The good thing is that I think she understands the challenges that I go through, and I understand the ones that she does. And So, you know, if she's got a grant deadline, I'm babysitting, I'm making lunches, and vice versa. And, you know, in the past couple of months, I traveled half of October, she traveled half of September. We communicate, we make it work. But it's not easy, it's not always, you know, piece of cake. But we managed to make it happen. And I think the fact that we can share our science has really enriched us. I mean, we read each other's papers and grants. We tell each other when we think, you know, sounds like a good idea, but it's probably not. Or, hey, did you think of doing this? And, you know, nobody is a better reviewer than somebody who's that close to you. Yeah. So my science has unquestionably grown because of interacting with her and her lab as well. So we're fortunate now to have our labs right next to each other. Even though she's at UCSD and I'm at Sanford Burnham, we're in this Sanford Consortium building.
Right.
And so we have our labs right next to each other, and we can interact and, of course, decide who's going to pick up the kids, but also decide, you know, can we buy a piece of equipment together? Can we learn this technique from you? So on.
Yeah. Is there anything, I mean, you mentioned this little interesting interlude as a science journalist. Is there anything else that you have seriously considered doing? Are you frustrated? Anything else?
I'm frustrated. I think if I were not going to do scientific research, I would probably write and teach. I think academia is in my blood. And I think that nothing gives me more pleasure than explaining things to people, whether it's on paper or in public or in a classroom. Mm-hmm. And when I was faculty at Duke for about 10 years before I moved here, and had the opportunity to teach graduate students. And of course, I teach them in my lab to some extent, but teaching them in a class is another experience. And it's challenging, but it's very enriching. So I think that even in the day-to-day, you know, giving talks and writing papers, I view it as along a spectrum of explaining things to people, explaining why what we do is interesting and important. So I think if I dropped this entirely, I'd probably be doing some kind of writing, some kind of communicating.
There's a question I always ask people, and with your wide reading, you might have an interesting answer here, which is that if I gave you a time travel token and let you bring to your dinner table anybody from any discipline, any time in history, is somebody you'd like to sit down and always wanted to ask questions of and say, how did you get that idea?
No one's asked me that before, so I don't have a prefab answer. And you can go forward too, though, right?
Oh, yes.
So I think I'd go forward, because I think I'd want to see how all this plays out. I mean, there's certainly fascinating people who I'd want to talk to from the past, but I'm amazed at how science has progressed in the time that I've been in it. And I can only imagine what it's going to look like 10, 20, 50 years from now. So, you know, I'd love to bring back a cancer biologist from 50 years from now, if there are still such. Or, you know, a physician who's dealing with neurodegenerative diseases and say, so how do you do this? You know, what are we missing?
Yeah, or did my work help?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that much.
So you really would like a time traveler to come back?
Yes, yes, I think so.
What's the destination that you hope that your research passion will eventually arrive at?
You know, we work on a childhood brain tumor. We work on a disease that is not as common as many other diseases, but is just incredibly devastating. And I've had the opportunity to meet kids with brain tumors and their parents. And I have kids. And so the thought that something that we do could save the lives of these kids gets me out of bed when my grants are not being funded. You know, I'd love to be able to look in the face of the mom of one of these kids and say, we know what to do. Mm-hmm. We know how we can help them.
Yeah. What are you optimistic about?
I'm actually optimistic about that. I think impatient, certainly. I think that it's taking longer than we'd like it to, but there's been a tremendous amount of progress in our understanding of these diseases, and a tremendous amount of new technology that's allowed us to be able to both study the diseases and, I think, in the near future, turn those the studies into treatments. So I'm very optimistic. I wish that the funding climate were not such that it's so hard for good people to do this, because I think there's a sense in which people are the rate limiting step here. And to the extent that we cannot support enough people in this enterprise, we're going to move more slowly. We'll still get there. But I think that we need to feed this plant. We need to make it grow. And if we starve it, things will wither.
Well, it's been fun talking to you, Rob Wixler-Rea. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Good
it's
luck.
A pleasure.